named Henry. Mommy stars on the show Bones. Daddy David Hornsby is on Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Chris Foster.
Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling is a live call-in radio program providing doctrinal dialogue, cultural commentary, and insightful interviews with some of today's foremost Christian authors and leaders. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Traveler's Rest. The goal of the church and the radio program is to seek the glory of God in the salvation of sinners and the sanctification of the saints by the ministry of the Word. For more information, go to www.knowingthetruth.org. Here with today's edition of Knowing the Truth is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome into this Thursday edition of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. Welcome aboard. We're going to have an interesting discussion today. I feel like I've been going all day here today in the studio. I filled in this morning for Dr. Tony Beam on the morning program during the called Christian Worldview Today, the drive time program here on Christian Talk 660. It runs from 7 o'clock in the morning until 9 o'clock. And so we had an interesting discussion this morning. We were talking a little bit about some comments that I made on Tuesday's broadcast here on Knowing the Truth. And I had made some comments about Michelle Bachmann's comments about viruses and vaccines, even more specifically, the HPV vaccine. And so we were discussing that a little bit on the program this morning and some of the news items surrounding that, and had a number of callers discussing that particular issue. Later on in the program, we switched gears a little bit, and we had Trevin Wax join me. Trevin is with Lifeway Christian Resources, and he has an interesting feature on his blog called Worth a Look. And every Tuesday in the month of September, Trevin has been visiting with me on this broadcast, and he wasn't able to make it this Tuesday. So he said, hey, do you have another day this week we could do it? And I said, no, I'm sorry. My Wednesday and Thursday program are already filled and not going to be able to do it. And then when I was asked to co-host for Tony, I said, hey, maybe Trevin's up at that time of the morning and we can get him in. And so we did that. And we had a great discussion this morning talking about one of the things was whatever happened to evangelism. Well, the subject here today that we're going to talk about is kind of deals with that a little bit. It's we're going to look at the subject of the four views of the spectrum of evangelicalism. What do we mean by evangelicalism today? I think there's a lot of discussion about that word, and I think we find out as we think about this subject that there is quite a bit of disagreement as to what exactly that means. And so on the program today, we're going to talk to one of the co-editors of a brand new book called The Spectrum of Evangelicalism, Four Views of the Spectrum of Evangelicalism, I should say more correctly. There's four contributors to this book, and there's two co-editors of the book. One is Colin Hansen, who you may remember was on the program with me not that long ago, talking about the subject of revival and revivalism. And then Andy Nicelli is also a co-editor of this book. And Andy has graciously agreed to come into the studio, an in-studio guest today, to talk about this important subject. Andy's involved in very many things. He is currently a research manager for D.A. Carson. He's the administrator of something called the Journal called Themelius. It's a very interesting journal, very academic in its approach, very deep in its theology. Highly recommend it. Maybe we can talk a little bit about where you can get a copy of that as we go through the broadcast. He has also taught New Testament Greek, so I'm going to have to be very careful here. He also taught that in an undergraduate as well as graduate levels. He currently teaches Bible and theology as an adjunct faculty at several colleges and seminaries. He's the author of the book Let Go and Let God, which is a survey and an analysis of the Keswick theology. I had Andy on the program to talk about that. Really enjoyed that discussion. And just last month, I was looking over the page views on my websites, and I believe it was second or third most downloaded broadcast for that month was the discussion that Andy and I had about let go, let God. And that has a question mark after it as to whether that's the right approach to sanctification in the Christian life. So that was a very interesting discussion. He has also published nearly 20 articles, 40 book reviews, and a few books. And so, Andy, thank you for taking time out of your very busy schedule to be with us to explain this book to us here on the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
My pleasure, Kevin.
Andy, tell us a little bit about how this book came about, maybe, and a little bit of a summation of what people will find in this book about evangelicalism.
Sure. Well, I got the idea in 2007, so it's 2011 now, 4 years it took for this thing to finally make it out. But at the time, I had just finished school at Bob Jones University and then was at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. So I just moved to kind of different orbits of the evangelical and fundamentalist worlds. And so in my mind, I was working through the differences and similarities, and I thought, you know, it'd be good to have a book that discusses these in a knowledgeable, ironic way.
Mm-hmm.
So I mentioned this at a meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society in a book stall to a man who works for Zondervan named Stan Gundry. He's a vice president there. And he thought it was a great idea. I should pursue it. So I brainstormed and thought, how's the best way to break this down? And that took a long time to try to figure out who would be the best person to represent each view and what the view should be. But eventually, we decided on four views. And the four contributors are Kevin Bowder, who represents a fundamentalist view, Albert Moeller, what he calls a confessional evangelical view, John Stackhouse, and this is his term, he called it generic evangelicalism, and Roger Olson, post-conservative evangelicalism. So what the book is doing is comparing and contrasting those four positions on the current evangelical spectrum in light of the history of North American evangelicalism.
And we should say that the format of the book is that they give their view and then they allow the other contributors to critique what they've said from their perspective. Is that correct?
That's right. It's part of a series by Zondervan called Counterpoints. Mm-hmm. And that's a trademark of the series where it's a debate book. Mm-hmm. You write an essay, and then the other contributors each respond to your essay.
Mm. I've had a few of these on before, and you know, it's a very interesting way to go through a book. Tell us a little bit. There were a couple of terms that you mentioned there that maybe we should define a little bit. You mentioned the word confessional just a moment ago when you talked about Dr. Moeller. What is actually meant by that idea of being a confessional evangelical? We may say confessional, maybe if there was somebody from a Roman Catholic background, they might be thinking, mm-hmm. we're thinking about the box in the mm-hmm. back of the church.
Yeah.
So maybe a Presbyterian background like myself immediately would think of Westminster Confession of Faith or something. Mm-hmm. Is that what any of those types of things, what's meant by this word?
Well, let me just explain the difficulty that Al Moeller was in when he chose this term. It basically came down to one of two terms, confessional or conservative evangelical. When you choose your adjective to go before the word evangelical, it's you're in a bind because people are going to think that adjective means different things. So if you say conservative evangelical, in our broader culture, people generally think politically.
Mm-hmm.
They think, oh, you're a Republican. You know, that's not what he's trying to communicate.
Sure.
He's trying to communicate theologically conservative evangelical. So you kind of have to, you know, choose your least worst poison.
It's yeah,
like,
exactly.
So which term are you going to go with? So he chose confessional, and that's traditionally, if you say you're confessional, it means you hold to a confession, like you hold to the Westminster Confession of Faith.
Right.
What Moeller means is he's insisting that the term evangelical is most useful when it has doctrinal content. So he doesn't want to say conservative evangelical, though he probably would take that label too, but he didn't choose it because that could be taken as social conservative or political conservative, which is a different thing. In the book, on pages 74 and 75, he explains this. And personally, he does hold to a confession. It's the Baptist Faith and Message and the Abstract of Principles at his seminary, but he's not is saying that everyone has to hold that view to espouse his position in this book.
Mm-hmm. So I took it as almost a synonym for the idea of doctrinal, that there's a body of statements or statements of faith that he is just saying that these get emphasized in that branch of evangelicalism. Is that a fair statement?
Sure. I just want to be careful that I want to be fair to the other views, the fundamentalist view, even the generic evangelical view and the post-conservative evangelical view. They would say, well, does that mean ours isn't doctrinal? So,
yeah,
then again,
sure.
Problem with labels.
Yeah. Well, let's ask about that that next one then. You said that and made the distinction when you read it, but he used the term generic evangelical. What was he trying to convey in that term generic then?
Let me just quote what he says in part of his essay. You can hear it in his own words. John Stackhouse, who's Canadian, writes this: evangelicalism cannot be sharply characterized in its beliefs, affections, and practices beyond understanding it to be observant Protestant Christianity expressed in authentic, vital discipleship issuing forth in mission with similarly concerned Christians of various stripes. As such, the definition of evangelicalism is inherently contestable, only because the definition of authentic and healthy Christianity is inherently contestable. So this is the big tent view.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be like the view most associated with a periodical like Christianity Today.
Mm-hmm. When you hear those statements like that, you know, it becomes very quickly we say, wow, that sounds really good.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
And boy, that should fit into the first two that we discussed here, first two that we mentioned. How about let's just do the last one here, and then we can start looking at what they use, what specific items they were addressing within evangelicalism. But the last one here is listed as a post-conservative evangelicalism. I would assume since Moeller could have used the word conservative up there, we could also say post-confessional evangelicalism.
Oh, I don't know.
Can we switch it that way?
Probably not, yeah. Olson, what he's doing is he's, of the four contributors, he's the furthest to the left if you had to put on a spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying, look, to define the term evangelical or evangelicalism is just futile.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it. You should stop doing it. Organizations are bounded sets, but movements aren't. And evangelicalism is a movement. So he says the movements are centered sets. So I'm quoting him from the book here. He says, evangelicalism has no definable boundaries and cannot have them. And without boundaries, it's simply impossible to say with certainty who is and who is not an evangelical.
Mm-hmm.
So he thinks that the first two views, the fundamentalist view, the confessional evangelical view, are just obsessed with boundaries
mm-hmm.
in an unhelpful way.
Mm. Okay, that's it. That's open for discussion here in a little bit. Obviously, we do like boundaries. I think that there's some protection involved in the idea of boundaries. And without any boundaries whatsoever, you know, obviously we could run into trouble. But we'll talk about that if we get here to it in our discussion. Let's talk about now some of the criteria that they were looking at in order to compare and contrast, like
mm-hmm.
you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was the evangelicals and Catholics together doctrine or document that came out. So I guess there's a little bit of co-belligerence here, right? I mean, whether or not evangelicals can be co-belligerents with Catholics, is that a fair way to put it?
No, it's not actually, because co-belligerency is with reference to politics. It's saying that regardless of your theological view, we can get together on this social issue and in lockstep, say, opposing abortion. That's co-belligerency.
Mm-hmm.
But we're talking on a theological plane. Can an evangelical and a Roman Catholic agree theologically on doctrines as core as justification by faith alone?
Mm.
That's a different matter.
Sure, sure. And of course, people, I think, would still be familiar with ECT, or Evangelicals and Catholics Together, but basically it was an effort by Chuck Colson and John Newhouse, right, and others
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
to try to bridge that gap to say, hey, we, in some ways, to say, hey, we really all believe the same thing, and therefore we should stop proselytizing and this type of thing. But as you're talking about, the points are critical to an understanding of Christianity, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
But again, my role as editor wasn't to infuse my view into the book across the board. It
right.
was to kind of be a referee to make it a fair fight, a fair debate.
Okay.
But
So this is one of the things that they're going to look at, how they react, whether they accept or reject something like ECT.
Right. So when we laid out the book, we said, here are your instructions. Define and defend. Define evangelicalism and defend your view of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then at least address three specific issues. So ECT is one of the three.
Okay, and a newer version, that's not a fair way to put it, but the Manhattan Declaration mm-hmm. was another wave in this same type of attempt, apparently.
Right.
I actually had Ligon Duncan came on mm-hmm. shortly after it was signed.
Yeah.
And, he was adamant that that was not what they were doing. He said that they had a lot of discussion behind the scenes,
mm-hmm.
and the critique was that, well, you guys should have made that more available for general consumption, because a lot of people didn't get that out of the actual statement itself and saw it as ECT2 or something or 3 or whatever it would be. So that was another part of that first one, right?
Correct.
Okay. The second thing then was to evaluate the idea of doctrinal boundaries, or what are the essential doctrines that make up sound evangelicalism. Is that a correct way to put the second point that you were looking at?
The other two are open theism and penal substitutionary atonement.
Okay.
So which one of those are you?
Well, that would have been the open theism.
Okay,
I put it in a much broader way.
Yeah.
But zeroing in then on the idea of open theism, and for our listening audience, open theism, a very short definition, whether or not God knows the future, right?
That could be one way to discuss
okay.
it, yeah.
And just for purposes of a working definition,
sure.
does God know what is going to happen next or not? Can man's choices alter what is going to take place next? Those types of subjects. And then the third one you looked at was you gave them as a criteria to write about, was the idea of the atonement, right? What they believe about the atonement.
More specific is, what do you think about penal substitutionary atonement,
okay.
not just the atonement, but
okay.
that specific narrowing in on the doctrine.
Okay. Theory of the atonement, I guess, put in the category.
Well, if you look open any systematic theology book, it'll have different, quote, theories of the atonement.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even like that term. But the idea is, if they say you've got an example theory, this theory, that theory,
sure.
penal substitution is one of them.
Right.
But that's the one that is most contested in the spectrum of evangelicalism. So
mm-hmm.
that's why understanding what your view of that particular doctrine of the atonement is says a lot about your view of evangelicalism.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
it's a good test case.
And again, penal substitutionary atonement, that's a broadcast in itself. But again, just a little bit more working definition of it. The idea of penal, that there's a legal element to it, and the price being poured out for our sins upon Christ as our substitute, and that way of our sins, of us being made justified before God. Is that a fair assessment of penal substitutionary atonement?
I guess so, yeah. The core idea is that Jesus died in the place of sinners and took the wrath of God in their place.
Mm-hmm.
God punished Jesus instead of me.
Mm-hmm.
That's the really
Some
core.
People may hear that and they might think, well, who in evangelical would evangelicalism would differ with that,
quite
or have issue with?
Yeah.
So all the way to some that have called it cosmic child abuse and those types of statements. So we'll talk about that hopefully as we go through this. Okay, we've got the groundwork laid, I think, for these four discussions here, these four views. Let's start on the first one here, under fundamentalism. He does a very good job, Kevin Bowder, you said, and he does an excellent job here of articulating the view. So let's talk a little bit. Give us a little summation about what he says in his article here about this topic of fundamentalist view of evangelicalism.
Sure. Kevin Bowder has thought about this for years and years and years. If you just Google his name, Kevin Bowder, and fundamentalism, you'll see dozens and dozens of articles. So this is just crystallizing his thought for years, and he does it well. Here's basically the essence of his argument. When he defends fundamentalism, he's defining and defending the idea of fundamentalism, not the movement of fundamentalism. And that distinction between an idea and a movement for him is crucial. Because if you look at the movement of fundamentalism now, he wouldn't want to associate himself with parts of it. Parts of it he calls hyper-fundamentalism,
mm-hmm.
Which is influenced by what he calls populist revivalism. So when he defines the idea of fundamentalism, what he does is he says there are different levels of Christian fellowship. And if you think of a spectrum, there are two poles on that spectrum. And at one end, you've got minimal Christian fellowship, and at the other end, you have maximal Christian fellowship. So first, he talks about minimal Christian fellowship. He says, at minimum, Christians have fellowship based on what he calls fundamentals. That's where the name fundamentalism comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Fundamentals. So he says, quoting him, he says, those are explanations, presuppositions, and implications on which the gospel depends. So the gospel, he says, draws the boundary of Christian fellowship. Those who are outside the boundary must not be recognized as Christians. So for him, that's minimal Christian fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
Then on the other side of the spectrum is maximal Christian fellowship. He says that occurs when Christians are, I'm quoting him now, united by the entire system of faith and practice, the whole counsel of God. So in other words, he's saying, well, while Christians can fellowship with all Christians on that minimum level, the minimal level, they must, and quoting him now, limit their cooperation, end quote. So separate, mm-hmm. or limit their cooperation on other levels, or separate from, and this is really the distinguishing mark from the other views, separate, quote, from Christian leaders who will not separate from apostates,
mm-hmm.
end quote.
Mm.
So that really summarizes his argument.
So the first part of it, the minimal
mm-hmm.
View that he gives there of fellowship, there would be some questions among other evangelicals as to what fits in that list.
Absolutely, because
right?
It depends on the definition of the gospel.
Right. And so even in stating that, it sounds like, okay, everybody agrees with this, and so if you agree with this list and everybody is in, then you have a level of fellowship with them as being a brother and sister in Christ. The only problem is not everybody agrees with that list. They would add, many of them may not take away from that list of the fundamentals of the faith, but some may add a few items to it that they would say, if you don't believe these certain items, then, you know, I wouldn't consider you to really be a believer. Or they might say something like, I don't understand how you could be a believer and then not believe one of these elements, that one of these things that they would add to the list. But you and I went on that trip to the Grand Canyon, and Tony Beam went on it this year. And one of the elements there was believing in a young earth. There might be some people that would say that needs to be added to the list. Obviously, Answers in Genesis makes a strong statements about that and articulates it very well. I believe in a young earth creationist viewpoint myself, and so I think it's very good. But some people would say that that is part of the litmus test of whether or not you could even be a Christian. Items like that, right?
I don't think mainstream fundamentalists, what Bowder calls mainstream fundamentalists, would associate that issue
no.
with fundamentals.
I was giving an example.
Right, right.
Yeah.
You're right that some might, in practice,
mm-hmm.
if you don't believe that view,
mm-hmm.
then they're going to limit their cooperation with you on just about all levels.
Mm-hmm.
So it's essentially separating because they don't share that view.
Okay.
Sure, that happens.
Yeah, and so you mentioned about, he goes in the first part of his then here to really define the gospel, and he goes through with the mm-hmm. first part of his article, and he talks about the difference between the invisible church and the visible church, and about the gospel and history and doctrine, and it's all very good. He does an excellent job of laying that out. The issue comes in, it seems, as you mentioned there, when he talks about the subject of separation.
Mm-hmm.
And the separation, I guess, even further, drilling down deeper in that, is separation that occurs on what's called, degrees of separation.
Mm-hmm.
So not only do you separate from a person who holds to views that you differ, that you don't agree with, but also if that person has any sort of relationship with another person who holds to errant views, even though they don't believe them themselves,
mm-hmm.
but they differ with you about how much they can get along with that other person, then they would believe. That's a fair assessment of what second-degree separation means?
Sure. John Woodbridge, a professor of history at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, church history, he defines it this way. He says second-degree separation means that if you find someone whom you think is theologically or ethically compromised, you must separate from that person as well as from other people who have not separated from that first individual.
Mm-hmm.
So here's how that might flesh out in real life. Let's say there's someone who is theologically or ethically compromised, maybe a theological liberal who denies key elements of the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
So we cannot have Christian cooperation with that theological liberal because we don't share the Christian gospel in common.
Mm-hmm.
That's what fellowship is, holding that in common. So there's no fellowship there. But that's the first degree. So you would separate.
Mm-hmm.
But the second degree is what Woodbridge says, as well as from other people who have not separated from that first individual. So a fundamentalist would say, if I see this evangelical over here with whom I can have fellowship because we do share the gospel in common, but he's engaging in Christian fellowship with that theological liberal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really confusing, and it's really wrong. And the Bible commands me to treat that evangelical brother in a specific way, namely, not to have Christian cooperation with him because of his granting having Christian cooperation with a theological liberal.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, good point. And I guess the only issue comes up with if the separation from this theological liberal is over a fundamental issue.
Right.
And the problem comes in if the separation is over a secondary issue, or I don't know exactly how that's termed there, but over an issue that is outside the fundamentals.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I think, that they don't agree with what that person is doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then that separation, I think, becomes a problem, that you're trying to enforce your secondary preferences or issues upon that other person, get them to do it by breaking off mm-hmm. fellowship with them. Then I think it's actually an unbiblical separation that takes place, that you're separating from them without a good biblical reason for doing so. So you were going to read something,
well,
I think?
Well, Bowder, in his essay on pages 43 to 45, has a section called hyper-fundamentalism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he's going out of his way to say, I'm defining and defending the idea of fundamentalism, but here's how it's actually, the movement has fleshed out in many places, and till many people, when they hear fundamentalism, they're thinking of what he calls hyper-fundamentalism. So he defines this with eight characteristics. So some of them involve what you just described as
right.
separating over non-essentials in a petty way that is not prizing the gospel, but trying to say it in a nice way. I can't think of a nice way to say it. There's petty, yeah.
Yeah, that does it. I think petty hits the, I think accurately describes it. And then let me read through a few of these on hyperfundamentalism, because it was interesting that he listed these. So he says, first, hyperfundamentalism often understands fundamentalism only in terms of loyalty to an organization, movement, or a leader. Secondly, it sometimes adopts a militant stance regarding some extra-biblical or even anti-biblical teaching. Third, hyperfundamentalists understand separation in terms of guilt by association. Fourth, hyperfundamentalists are marked by an inability to receive any criticism. Fifth, the characteristic of hyperfundamentalism is anti-intellectualism. Sixth, hyperfundamentalism sometimes turns non-essentials into tests of fundamentalism.
That's what you were hitting
at. Yeah, that would fit under that. And seventh, he says, hyperfundamentalism occasionally treats militant political involvement as a criterion for fundamentalist standing. Eight, and last, hyperfundamentalists sometimes hold to a double standard of personal ethics. In other words, under that one, if I remember right, he talks about that they make these statements, name-calling, half-truths, innuendo, they think that that's a legitimate weapon in the culture wars, but yet they would not use that same type of terminology in personal relationships or dealing with people on a personal level. And so I think he's right, and it's coming from him. So, I mean, I think people would be much more received by people. This whole idea of that we're talking about evangelicalism and fundamentalism, though,
mm-hmm.
I think it was Moeller in the opening part of his critique of this, says, what does evangelicalism have to do with fundamentalism? I think coming from the understanding that fundamentalists, I thought, always distanced themselves from evangelicalism. They didn't really like the term, and that, I'm not an evangelical, I'm a fundamentalist.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Well, I think that, properly speaking, all fundamentalists are evangelicals. So you think of a big umbrella and call that evangelicalism. And under that umbrella, you have these four views and others. So all fundamentalists are evangelicals, but it doesn't go in reverse. Not all evangelicals are fundamentalists. So in this discussion, when we contrast fundamentalists with evangelicals, the evangelicals we're talking about are the non-fundamentalist evangelicals. Mm. But all fundamentalists are evangelicals in that sense.
I wanted to ask you about another topic, but we're going to take a quick commercial break. I wanted to ask you about, does the subject of inerrancy of the scriptures come into play much in this? I know Colin brings it up in the introduction, but I noticed just now as we're going through this discussion that it wasn't part of one of the three or four items that were discussed there. So I just wanted to ask you about that when we come back from the break. We're in a very interesting discussion about evangelicalism from a book called Four Views on the Spectrum of Evangelicalism. We're meeting with Andy Nicelli, co-editor of this book. We'll be back in just a couple moments.
You're listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. For more information about today's program, the radio ministry, and the resources we offer, go to www.knowingthetruth.org.
We see the evidence of alcoholism all around us. Broken marriages, early death, and untold accidents, many of them deadly. One of the hidden wounds of alcohol addiction is the impact it has on the lives of the children of alcoholics. Hear the story of Katie Sellers, child of an alcoholic, when she comes to Peace Talk this Monday at 12:30 here on Christian Talk 660 FM 92.9. That's Peace Talk, your place to find hope, get help, and discover peace.
It's great pizza for a great price. So pack up the family and head over to Stevie B's near Walmart on Woodruff Road in Greenville. At Stevie B's, you'll find friendly faces and at least a dozen pizzas out at all times. Or you can order a pizza and they'll make it fresh just for you at no extra cost. So visit Stevie B's today.
Hi, this is Pastor Kevin Bowling, and I want to take the time to thank John, Ruth, Carlos, and the good folks over there at Stevie B's Pizza for their support of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
Mom, Dad,
what is it, honey?
Well, you know that Melissa's transferring, and she's been telling me all about this amazing school. It's a charter school, and can I go there?
Slow down, Katie.
We've been through this. Private schools are just too...
But Mom, it's...
Fact. All charter schools are public schools.
And Melissa told me that kids really
get... Katie, we just don't have the money to send you to...
Fact. Charter schools are tuition-free.
And Melissa said that the kids in this school are really motivated to...
Fact. Charter schools are boosting student achievement.
So can I enroll, please?
The National Alliance for Public Charter Schools wants you to know the facts about charter schools. 1.6 million students attend nearly 5,000 charter schools and receive a free, quality public education.
Well, sounds great to me.
Honey, we'll start the enrollment process today.
Already started it, Mom, but I could use some help.
For more information, visit the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools. Visit www.publiccharters.org. That's publiccharters.org. And get the facts.
Welcome back to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Information regarding the resources referenced on today's program can be found at www.knowingthetruth.org. Now, here to continue with today's program is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome back into the second half of the program today. We're going to go ahead and continue to go through this book that we're talking about here today. It's called The Four Views on the Spectrum of Evangelicalism. By the way, it's published by Zondervan. You can go out to their website to check it out, www.zondervan.com. If you've got questions or comments about what we're talking about today, I want to let you know that I am giving away copies of the book. And so if you would like a copy of this book, be happy to put a couple in your hand, well, one copy per caller in your hand, but I'll be happy to give away a few of them on the radio program today. We have a limited supply of them to be able to give out. So if you've got a question about this, what is evangelicalism, maybe a question about one of these four views, fundamentalism, confessional evangelicalism, generic evangelicalism, or post-conservative evangelicalism, what is meant by that and how does that relate to one of the other ones, be happy to take your question or your comment today during the program. The number here, the way to do that is very simply to use our toll-free number. That number is 1-888-660-WLFJ. That's 1-888-660-WLFJ. 660-9535. Also, I have email up and running, so if you want to send a quick question or a comment via email, you can do that. The email address is just very simply kevin@knowingthetruth.org. That's kevin@knowingthetruth.org. Back to our discussion now with Andy Nocelli. Andy, of course, is the co-editor along with Colin Hansen as general editors of this book. And so just appreciate the work that they've done going over what's, for many, a very difficult, complex issue, and they're trying to sort through it all. And so books like this really help us to be able to think through this subject in a biblical manner. Andy, just for the break, I asked you about the subject of the scriptures themselves and looking at the idea of the inerrancy of scripture. I know that that was a major debate. Colin brings that up as well in the introduction. Mm-hmm. I just didn't see it listed as one of these items that right. they were asked to write about. Why was it not in that list, mm-hmm. I guess? And is it mentioned throughout the book?
Right. It's not one of the three issues we have, but as you see in the index, all four views talk about it several times.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not an issue that any of the views would say, if you don't believe in the inerrancy of Scripture, you can't be a Christian.
Mm.
So in that sense, it's not a fundamental, like penal substitution is for the first two views.
Mm.
So it's on a different level than that.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean it's unimportant to
yeah.
those first two views either.
Right.
They argue that it's crucial. Now that issue is huge.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's another Zondervan Counterpoints book in the works.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's called Five Views mm-hmm. on Inerrancy. So that's on the way.
That's a little problematic because I would have had that in the fundamentals in the list there. I would have put it down as being that if you didn't hold to the inerrancy, plenary, verbal mm-hmm. inspiration of Scripture, that you couldn't be, I wouldn't consider you a believer. You know, I would think that there'd be a problem with that.
Well, because, there's a difference of saying you couldn't be a believer and there's a problem. So
yeah,
those are very different issues.
Yeah, right.
There are many, many good Christians, especially in Britain, for example,
mm-hmm.
who would not hold to inerrancy the way most of the conservative evangelicals do.
Yeah, but they enjoy Monty Python, too, so, you know, so let's just dismiss that old country.
I wouldn't be prepared to call them non-Christians
yeah.
over that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just would be surprised that many people would call themselves an evangelical. In fact, I kind of use, you know, with some of these words, you have a synonym that you mm-hmm. think in your mind when you think of this. Somebody says to me, what do you mean by evangelical? One of the first things I say is, I mean Bible-believing. And mm-hmm. so now, if mm-hmm. I build in there that evangelical may mean that the person doesn't even believe that the Bible is, you know, inspired by God, plenary, full inspiration of the Scripture, mm-hmm. I'd be right away like, wait a second.
Are you thinking in your mind that evangelical necessarily equals Christian, and all Christians are evangelical?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so you're using them synonymously.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah,
the book is actually using the term evangelical both theologically and sociologically.
Okay.
So we're talking about North American evangelicals in particular.
Okay. So they make a profession of faith versus the possession of faith. I think that was the way it was worded by Bowder.
That's part of the concept. But more along the ideas of a robust evangelicalism isn't necessarily equivalent to all Christians.
Mm.
So I wouldn't. That's not what the authors are saying. That's
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, different levels of growth or whatever.
Well,
within
it'd be recognizing, for example, there could be someone within the system of Roman Catholicism
mm-hmm.
who, in spite of that system, not believing everything in that system, is embracing the gospel
yeah.
and is a genuine Christian.
Okay,
so it allows for that type of thing.
Okay, and that's exactly what I was talking about. And when I looked at that, I was thinking about that. I use that same thing about Roman Catholicism. I came out of Roman Catholicism, make a very strong point about being against ECT and those types of things. And so, but I would say, just as you said, that there are people in there, they couldn't hold to the teachings
mm-hmm.
of Roman Catholicism and still be saved. But there could be people in there that are bad Catholics, that are ignorant of what's actually being taught and don't hold to it, and those I would hold to
right.
that they could be saved in spite of being in that church.
And sociologically, they're not evangelicals.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Okay. All right. This gets more and more complex. Let's run to the phone line for a second, and John is up. John's got a question, I think, about young earth evangelicals. John, I asked that just a few moments ago, and I don't know if you got to hear that, but maybe it's a follow-up to what I had said.
No, it's not. It's not. But since you mentioned that, I will add this. I've been doing, I've been in the creation movement for 30 years, and I don't think I have ever met a believer who's a creationist who would say that if you don't believe in six-day creation, you can't be a Christian. Mm-hmm. I think that there are soteriological and epistemological issues, but I don't think it's the I don't think it makes you not a Christian if you don't believe in young earth creation. That might have been an overstatement or mm-hmm. I don't know. I've never met anybody that said you can't be a Christian if you don't believe in six-day creation.
Yeah, when I posed the question, I put it there as a hypothetical, but I know what you're referring to. I was just pointing out anything that people would add other things to the list of the mm-hmm. fundamentals, and then I went on to do it there with the issue of the yeah. inerrancy of Scripture. But you're right, John. I wasn't implying, I guess, that anybody in particular that I knew of that would do that, but just making a point there is what we were talking about.
Yeah, and strategically, from the other side, it's often said from those who are from scholars and apologists for non-young earth positions, for old earth or theistic evolutionary positions, they will throw that back and say, well, you're saying that if you don't believe in young earth creation, you're saying that if somebody doesn't believe in young earth creation, they can't be a Christian. And all day long, all my breath, No. Don't mm-hmm. characterize us like that. That's a strategic straw man ploy, and I'm always dealing with that, but never from within the camp, but from without the camp. But my question had to do with, is it almost seems like, would you agree or disagree that it almost, oh, let me say this. Listen, inerrancy is serious, and it almost appears, in my opinion, 30 years of reading and studying, that the evangelical movement is trying to excise key issues like origins and inerrancy just because they're problematical. But it almost seems as if evangelicalism is been so enlarged, so expanded as to include liberal Christianity. And mm-hmm. frankly, help me to understand, how can you not cognitively, intelligently believe that the Bible has errors in it? And I can see how you can be a Christian, but you can't be evangelical in the sense of being, you know, a believer or evangelical in the sense of believing the gospel. It is so, the word written is so inextricably linked to the word incarnate. How do you tease out the two without destroying Christianity?
Well, that's exactly what we're talking about, because you say, how can you be evangelical? We're trying to nail down then what do we mean by that when we say that you're evangelical? And apparently, you know, there's various views about that. As I just mentioned, I mentioned it either being that you couldn't be a Christian or be extremely problematic. I would say that it's problematic that, like you're saying, that as you begin to look at other things and you start growing and looking at different doctrinal viewpoints, if you don't hold to the inerrancy of Scripture, I think you're going to be extremely inconsistent as you go along.
Oh, yeah,
and it's going
to
be
exactly,
yeah. You know, which part is real and which part isn't real. Yeah. Good question, John. I appreciate it. We're going to try to go on with a couple of these other views, but I appreciate you bringing that up again, and we're going to try to flesh that out as we go through. Let me ask you, Andy, just before the caller and the break, we were talking about moving on from the first view that's put here, the first by Kevin Bowder, onto the one that was articulated by Albert Mohler. And sometimes, you know, they look very, very similar. Mm-hmm. In fact, Mohler goes out of his way to commend Bowder mm-hmm. in the very beginning, saying that he appreciates what he wrote and those types of things. Where then is the difference between the two?
Okay. Well, on one hand, they're so similar because they're both describing evangelicalism theologically, primarily.
Mm-hmm.
And the other two are doing it some theologically, but primarily sociologically. So that last caller, one of the answers to him is, a lot of it depends on how you define evangelicalism. Are you going to take a sociological approach? Are you going to describe the kind of people who call themselves evangelical? Or are you going to take a theological approach? Are you going to prescribe what the Bible calls the gospel and holding to that? Those are two very different approaches, a sociological approach or a theological approach. Mm-hmm. Mohler and Bowder take a theological approach, and they come out basically at the same place. Not mm-hmm. There are some differences. Specifically, you want to know the differences. Well, One of them is that idea of secondary or second degree separation.
Mm-hmm.
It's applied differently largely in the two different camps. And here's one significant distinction. They disagree, it seems, on the timing of when to transition from separating from an institution by purging out or to separate by coming out. So you can separate in one of two ways, purging or coming. Purging out, coming out. And today, it seems like most fundamentalists think of separation as coming out and not purging out. What's happening, for example, with the Southern Baptist Convention, when it was so steeped in liberalism, fundamentalists were writing books saying it's hopeless. It's a hopeless cause.
Ichabod.
Get out.
Yeah.
Come out. Separate by coming out. But there were some people who were Orthodox who stayed in and said, we want to separate by purging out. And they did. And Moeller's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And today, looking back, we tip our hats to them because that was what they did, really, if you agree with their theological viewpoint, was heroic.
Mm-hmm.
And it was separation. But it's a wisdom issue of the timing, come out or purge out.
Mm-hmm.
And the fundamentalist view would tend to come out sooner.
Mm-hmm.
Make sense?
Yeah, they seem in the fundamentalist view to very quickly, immediately, to just say, well, that's it, we're done, we're out, you know, we can't have any fellowship, and that's mm-hmm. it. Where obviously the success story of the SBC gives people hope that there might be a way to you know, as you mentioned, purge it, but it's a lot of work, right?
Tons
of work behind the scenes that are taking place. And I guess there'd be denominations today, immediately I think of what's taking place in the PCUSA,
mm-hmm.
and their issue is complicated too because of the way the property is structured,
mm-hmm.
that the property belongs to the denomination, and to walk away you hand the property mm-hmm. back to the denomination. So you look and go, hey, the denomination has gone south, Ichabod is written over it, you know, they're just denying so many different things. And then but then you go, wait a second, but our local congregation doesn't do that, and are we actually going to then give this millions of dollars worth of property back to the denomination? And you know, how do we do that? We actually built up this church, mm-hmm. and we're the ones doing the work here.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sometimes I guess we look at these a little bit too black and white,
mm-hmm.
and don't consider some of the things associated with it. Many people would say to that situation, who cares about the money? You know, just stick with the Bible and, mm-hmm. and leave. And that's a valid point. But if there's a way to do it so that either you can bring reform or you can do it in a way that you don't lose out on all the things you worked for these many years, obviously that would be a reasonable solution as well, and something that we should look at.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're just not going to have the time, Andy, to go through all of the four views here. Do you want to take a shot at summarizing the other two? And because I want to get to the end, the conclusion that
sure.
you have here in the book, which I think is very helpful, so I want to make sure we get there.
Yeah, well, the other two, I've already described them at the beginning.
That's true.
So you've got an idea of them. But if you look at the three issues of evangelicals and Catholics together, open theism, and penal substitutionary atonement, the way it breaks down is that fundamentalism and confessional evangelicalism, those first two views, agree on each of those three issues. And then generic evangelicalism and post-conservative evangelicalism basically disagree with the first two views and agree with each other
mm-hmm.
on those three issues. So for evangelicals and Catholics together, fundamentalism and confessional evangelicalism say that betrays the gospel.
Yes.
And the others say, no, it doesn't.
Mm.
On the issue of open theism, fundamentalism and confessional evangelicalism say that denies the gospel. And the other two say it's wrong, but it doesn't deny the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And on penal substitutionary atonement, fundamentalism and confessional evangelicalism says that's essential to the gospel. And the others say, the generic says it's essential to the gospel, but evangelicals may still deny it. And post-conservative evangelicalism says it's normal, but it's not essential.
Mm-hmm.
So you can kind of see how it's playing out. The first two views are agreed on those three issues. The second two disagree.
Mm. Within the first two that we talked about, mm-hmm. how would the fundamentalist view somebody like an Albert Mohler then?
It depends on the fundamentalist you're talking about.
Okay.
You want to talk about Kevin Bowder in particular? Because that's a little easier since he authored the
Okay,
review.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Well, how would he view Dr. Mohler and the type of work that he's doing? He appears on mm-hmm. CNN, mm-hmm.
Right.
Fox News, constantly out there commentating.
He could answer this better than I could, but from what he's written about it, I've sensed always great respect as a Christian brother, someone he tips his hat to and he thinks he can learn from and he honors, he doesn't, demean, but that he would have, in some capacities, some would limit his cooperation with him in on some levels.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not on all levels.
Right. Where would a T4A, Together for the Gospel...
Oh, T4G.
T4G, I mean, I'm thinking about Dan Kruger's group there. But T4G, where would that fit into this discussion? Would it be between those first two segments there? Would it be broader than that? Where would they play in this bigger argument about or discussion of...
Hal Mohler's one of the four guys
right,
of T4G, so it'd line up more with his view, yeah.
Okay, but I mean, it would... Is the T4G movement, where some of these distinctives that we hold to mm-hmm. are not as important as the gospel itself, would that play just among the two views, the first two views, or would it even flow over into any of those, the other two views that we discussed?
Well, this is one of the takeaways from the book, is that, in a sense, it reveals there's a deep divide within the movement called evangelicalism,
mm-hmm.
and on one side are these two views, fundamentalism and confessional or conservative evangelicalism, and they are very like-minded in many, many ways, in that T4G way, doctrinally, very much.
Mm-hmm.
The way they would differ from each other, most often from an outward perspective, is in some different cultural practices on areas like musical styles or dress codes or whatever, those sorts of things. It's relatively minor things. It's not open theism or inerrancy
mm-hmm.
or your view on ECT or penal substitution. It's not that level.
Mm-hmm.
The level is much more minor, but still fundamentalists wouldn't say it's so minor that it's not significant.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, good point. You, I think, in just most recent comments that you made here, really talked a little bit about your conclusion. But is there something else in the conclusion that we didn't bring out?
Yeah, several observations from the book. One is that not all evangelicals are going to identify with one of the four views in this book.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like these are the only four views.
Mm.
And some might identify with one of the views, but want to tweak it a little bit. So we're not claiming this is it. Everybody's going to identify with this. Another is that sometimes when we talk about evangelicalism, we're not talking about the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to be real careful to define our terms. So that's been real clear in this discussion. Another is that some people may come in contact with just a subset of one of these four views. Like my uncle is a fundamentalist. And it's what Bowder might call a hyper-fundamentalist. And mm-hmm. therefore they think that all fundamentalists are like their uncle. That kind of thing where
sure.
you've got to take the best of each view to understand it, and that's what we've tried to do in this book, is taking the best of each view and be careful not to caricature. And another thing I've learned from this project is that judgmentalism
mm-hmm.
is not exclusive to any particular view.
Mm.
It's easy to criticize people for being judgmental, especially when they're to the right of you. But anyone can be judgmental, whether you have the stricter views or the looser views.
Mm-hmm.
And then one last observation is that few people consider themselves extreme.
Hmm.
It's easy to set up an argument. There are wackos to my left and crazies to my right, and there's me in the reasonable middle.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always going to be someone to the left and right of you.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great insight, and looking at just how we think through these issues. There's so many different nuances of it and different elements involved in it. I really appreciate you going through this. What's your hope then for the book, to bring about that type of reasonable thinking to this issue?
Yeah, it's really so that people can watch a debate that is low on rhetoric and high on just understanding, and you can come out believing strongly, but believing and understanding who you're disagreeing with.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't just an academic issue. We're going to stand before God for what we do with the gospel, with mm-hmm. the evangel. And with Paul, conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. That's mm-hmm. what we got to do.
Mm-hmm. Andy, this has been extremely interesting. I thank you very much again, as I mentioned at the top of the broadcast, as I read off all the different things that you're involved in, for taking the time out to visit with us here in studio to discuss this important issue. Let me tell our listening audience that you can get a copy of this book by going out to Zondervan's website. That's www.zondervan.com. Go out there. The title of the book is called Four Views on the Spectrum of Evangelicalism. And again, it's co-edited by Andy, who is our guest here today, Andy Nicelli, and also then by Colin Hansen as well. And you can get yourself a copy of it out there. I'll be guest hosting the program tomorrow on Christian Worldview Today. But for this broadcast, I'll see you next week. Jesus said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free."
You've been listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Boling. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Travelers Rest. For more information about the church and radio ministry, visit us on the web at knowingthetruth.org.
The opinions expressed on today's program are those of the announcers, their guests, and callers, and do not necessarily represent those of the staff and management of His Radio Network, the Radio Training Network, or Clear Channel Communications.
Life-changing teaching and talk for the Carolinas and Georgia. Christian Talk 660, WLFJ, Greenville, Spartanburg, Anderson.